The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Banking Weekly from the Financial Times with me, Patrick Jenkins. Joining me in the studio today are Martin Arnold, our banking editor, Caroline Binham, our financial regulation correspondent, and Laura Noonan, our investment banking correspondent. From our New York office, we have Ben McClenahan, our US banking editor, and US financial correspondent, Alistair Gray. And also our guest from the IMD Business School in Lausanne is Professor Jennifer Jordan, who is Professor of Leadership and Organisational Behaviour. This week, we'll be discussing the latest developments at Wells Fargo in the US as a mis-selling scandal emerges. Secondly, we'll be looking at the Bank of England's very generous pension scheme. And finally, about how computers are being used to hire staff at Deutsche Bank. First, let's go over to Ben in New York on that Wells Fargo story.
So, Alistair, Wells Fargo, the world's biggest bank by market cap, was fined last week $185 million. That includes a record $100 million fine by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Wells was supposed to be the most wholesome bank in America, pretty much stayed above the fray amongst all those huge fines for mortgage securities, mis-selling and LIBOR manipulation, FX manipulation. So what's going on?
All the way back in 2013, there was an investigation published by the Los Angeles Times. It reported on allegations from former employees who were complaining about really intense pressure to meet their sales goals, things like, you know, hourly conferences on targets. If you don't meet your goal, you're supposedly chastised and embarrassed in front of dozens of managers in your area, according to former branch managers. And that led apparently to staff doing things like begging their friends and family to sign up, even forging signatures, opening unneeded accounts. It led the city of LA to file a lawsuit and ultimately national regulators to intervene. But what's emerged now is the scale of it, which has surprised people.
Yeah, literally millions of accounts that were created out of thin air.
As many as 2 million bank accounts and credit cards were apparently created without the customers knowing anything about it. 5,300 employees lost their jobs because of it. According to the regulators, at least, it's not fair to characterize this as kind of rogue employees.
5,000 of them?
No.
It's a lot of rogues.
Although Wells actually says that that's equivalent to 1% of its branch workforce over the five-year period. That's 5,300 people. That's a lot of people, admittedly, over 5 years. They say that because of staff turnover and things, that's equivalent to 1% of the branch workforce over the period. But I mean, however you look at it, yeah, it's clearly a lot of people.
Was this a victimless crime? I mean, how much do people actually suffer if you're creating an account that doesn't exist, if you're shuffling a bit of money and then you close it a few days later just to hit a sales target? Who's really hurt by that?
Well, Wells has been, as well as being fined $185 million, which, although it's a significant sum, it's not in the multi-billion league. It's also been required to set aside only $5 million for restitution. And that reflects really the nature of this scam. This was more about the employees meeting their sales goals and in some cases being eligible for higher bonuses than scamming customers out of large sums of money. I mean, if you've got a ghost account somewhere, probably unlikely to rack up huge fees.
Unless you trigger a minimum account balance, right, which is what's happened. I've spoken to some people who weren't necessarily keen to open an account, but it was sort of packaged as an essential element of doing business with Wells. And then when money was shuffled around a little bit, they inadvertently breach your thresholds, and that means you're charged, you know, a few dollars here and there.
So yeah, they've been required to set aside $5 million in restitution payments for this.
So that's, you know, as you say, pretty small sums, even though the conduct is pretty egregious. So what does it mean for Wells? On the morning after this all broke, the shares, they started fine by lunchtime, down about 2%. That's a lot in market cap terms. It's $5 billion. So what does it mean for Wells? Is this a serious threat, do you think, to their business model?
Well, cross-selling has been a really integral part of their entire business model for many years. They have been seen as the most successful bank in convincing customers to take out many products. You know, that could be insurance or pension investments or what have you. So the big question really is whether this episode will undermine that. And more bullish, optimistic case is that they can make changes. They've already been making changes, improve the procedures, improve training for staff to make sure this kind of thing doesn't happen again. The more skeptical, critical case is this has been so important for so long, is a more radical change of strategy required.
So is this matter serious enough with all these people going over all these many years? And surely the board had an inkling of what was going on here. Does this mean that John Stumpf, who's been CEO and chairman for a long time, is his position now under threat?
Dare I say it? No, probably not. As we discussed earlier, the sums involved are relatively small in far as the fine restitutions are concerned. Well, the wider context as well is they're still among the most profitable companies in the entire sector. It's the only big bank that produced double-digit ROE in recent months. It's got high-profile backing from Warren Buffett, Berkshire Hathaway, at least for now. The big question is really whether he, behind the scenes, makes noises about this, given that he's always emphasised how important ethics are in business.
Well, I'm joined now by Jennifer Jordan, who's Professor of Leadership and Organisational Behaviour at the Business School IMD. Jennifer, thank you very much for joining us. This is a depressing repeat, really, in some ways, of mis-selling scandals that we've had at so many other banks over the past few years. To what extent is this a failure, do you think, of controls by senior management? Or to what extent is the banking system rotten?
I actually don't think it's an issue of controls. I mean, there's problems with blaming it on controls. Number one, controls require monitoring. Controls are monitoring, and that requires considerable cost on the part of the bank. And I think the more systemic problem originates in three places. Number one, just in general, the depersonalization of the banking industry. So I'm a social psychologist by training, and I'm actually, by coincidence, I'm visiting a bank here today, and they were telling me that now only 1% of their transactions happen over the counter. And so I was thinking back to, you know, my childhood when I would go into the bank with my parents. They would have a relationship with the teller or their loan officer, et cetera. And it was very much of a face-to-face interaction. And as a social psychologist, I know that as things become depersonalized, both on the side of the business and on the side of the customer, we're willing to do things that are more unethical towards those parties, that are less scrupulous, et cetera. And of course, it's hard to get around, right? We live in a digital era. Things are not happening as much face-to-face, not only in banking, right? And then the loss of trust. So this is certainly a problem with the banking industry. Unfortunately, Wells Fargo emerged from the banking crisis around 2008 relatively unscathed. So it's a pity that they're now confronting this, right? They were kind of seen as one of the good guys at some point. And then lastly, just setting bad targets, right? So if employees have to open around 2 million fake accounts, there's a problem in the targets that were set. So I really don't think it's an issue of controls. I think it's a systemic issue. I also think there was a failure of values-based leadership. So the CEO on their website says, you know, everything we do is built on trust. It doesn't happen with one transaction in one day on the job or in one quarter. It's earned relationship by relationship. And unfortunately, that motto, that value statement, was clearly compromised here.
So what can a bank like Wells or any other bank that finds itself in this kind of situation do about this in practical terms? Because you can't really turn the clock back and re-personalize relationships, certainly on the scale of a Wells Fargo. I mean, we have small banks in some places that do that still. But what can a massive bank do, either in terms of changing its business model, or perhaps I was going to suggest maybe the pay structures around, you know, sales targets is obviously a part of it, as you say.
Well, I mean, the immediate issue that they have to confront is now a crisis issue, right? Repairing the broken trust. So before we're going to think about setting different targets, we need to think, how do we win back the trust of our customers, but also, you know, the American people in general? And that has to do, first of all, with making a clear apology and accepting responsibility for what happened, and also trying to rectify any financial damage. And also, you know, financial damage is one thing, but then the trust damage and repairing that takes a longer period. So that's one issue, right? And that's the immediate problem that they're dealing with. But then in terms of long term, if I was going to talk to the leaders at Wells Fargo, I would say you need, and I've seen this happen, not necessarily, I don't have examples of clients at banks, but in other large organizations where they say, okay, we have a financial target that you need to reach, which, by the way, is realistic. But we also have a values-based target that we need you to reach. So that could be something like you get a bonus for starting one initiative that exemplifies or embodies our core values. And I'm kind of talking out of both sides of my mouth because I said earlier, monitoring takes money, requires a lot of money, it requires cost, it requires time. And of course, financial targets, monitoring financial targets with a clear quantitative bottom line is much easier than monitoring something more soft, like, are you embodying our values or are you making initiatives that are consistent with our values in your behavior? Right? That's harder to monitor. And that's why organizations, you know, the quantitative bottom line is easier. That's why they tend to gravitate towards that. But clearly that's not working. There's problems with that method.
Well, as you say, getting the right model is very tricky. And I think one thing's for certain, we're going to see more examples of this kind of misbehavior emerging over the coming months and years. Professor Jordan.
I hope not.
I hope not too. Professor Jennifer Jordan, thank you very much for joining us. So let's go on to our second item. Caroline, you've been looking at a very interesting development of the Bank of England's pension scheme, where it seems like they're being rather generous with their staff.
Yeah, that's right. Given that we're facing a pensions funding crisis in this country, which has been widely attributed to the Bank of England's policy of quantitative easing, I thought it might be quite interesting to take a look at the bank's own pension scheme, which is often called gold-plated and all the rest of it. And anyway, it turns out that it's now 100% fully funded, and they've increased contributions to nearly 55% of members' pensionable salary, and that was up from 51.8% in 2014. And these kind of contribution rates would be definitely unaffordable in the private sector. And the reason why this is quite interesting is it looks like the Bank of England is immune to the policies that are having such a detrimental effect on pension schemes in the private sector. It has a defined benefit scheme in the sense that it's no longer final salary. About 8 years ago, the employees were put on an average of their salary over their career that they would then retire on. But it's certainly still very generous. And defined benefit schemes generally in the private sector, and there's about 6,000 out there in the corporate private sector, are the ones that are most affected, really, by QE.
Obviously, the other thing to say, I suppose, is that the Bank of England stands out from the broader banking sector. Martin, you've been looking at the pension systems of some of the private sector banks, the likes of RBS and Lloyds, which are both taxpayer-backed.
I have, yes, and they've both been forced to take action the last couple of years as they grapple with the deficits in their defined benefit pension schemes. They've both got very large defined benefit pension schemes. RBS earlier this year fast-tracked a £4.2 billion payment to its DBS scheme and changed its pension accounting policy to help plug its shortfall in its pension fund. And that resulted in a big hit to its reserves, which contributed to a big loss it made last year. Lloyds, on the other hand, has drawn fire from unions for cutting the cost of its DB scheme 2 years ago by capping employees' pensionable pay at existing levels, which generated a £1 billion gain for the bank. The other thing to say about banks in the UK and their pension deficits is that whilst the banks do have among the most generous pension schemes of the FTSE 100 companies, they are, by the regulator, they are forced to hold capital against the risk of their pension schemes and the deficits that they have there. So in a way, they are kind of covered if there is you know, problems in those pension schemes.
Back to the Bank of England, Caroline, what are the messages that this whole
debacle ascends. Is there going to be any rebellion over it, or is it just going to fizzle?
Well, I think certainly Ros Altman, who was the former UK pensions minister, has already spoken out quite strongly against it, and some MPs as well. I mean, I think there's just a sense that the Bank of England is perhaps being a little tin-eared about what's going on in the wider economy whilst increasing contributions to its own employees.
It doesn't do much to address that issue of the elite of London being seen to be disconnected from the rest of the country, which I know is something that the Bank of England is theoretically very worried about, but in practice perhaps not. Let's move on to the final topic for this week. Laura, you've been doing some very interesting research into a recruitment tactic at Deutsche Bank, the use of artificial intelligence to screen candidates for jobs.
So what Deutsche Bank have been doing in the States this year for part of their corporate and investment bank is that instead of using the traditional US recruitment model for investment banking jobs, which basically relies heavily on sending teams to onto the campuses of the top Ivy League schools and then going to interview students there, instead of that, Deutsche are using a new technology to basically screen a far larger group of students. So they will be screening tens of thousands, and they'll be screening them not just in terms of their academic performance, which has really been the traditional screening point, but they've also done this quite innovative thing where they've got a behavioral profiling model made up. And what they're basically trying to see is how well the behavioral makeup of these new graduates matches the best performing graduates who are already at the bank. So I think that's kind of the key thing that makes it different to a lot of these initiatives, because often you see people and they actually start out and say, well, we think people who are going to be team players are going to do well. We think people who are analytical are going to do well. And they kind of start off with a list of the desirable attributes. In the case of Deutsche, it's purely evidence-based. So what they do is they go in, they get all of their existing juniors to take these tests. They then see which of the characteristics do the people who are actually at the top of their area, which of those characteristics do they have? So if it turns out that actually people who are strongest for teamwork are in the bottom 10%, then in that case, Deutsche wouldn't seek people who were strongest for teamwork. So it's an interesting approach to do it on a much more evidence-based way rather than doing it on a theoretical, how do we want the bank to look way.
And is there a risk that people end up being carbon copies of each other?
Yeah, so that was one of the things that we talked about with the bank. And they basically said that they thought that they weren't too concerned, but they thought that the overall payoff far outweighed that risk. So in terms of the payoff, one of the biggest things they see is because they're working with this analytical company, any student who wants to apply to Deutsche Bank has to do the digital profile first. But they're also able to screen from about 30,000 CVs that the outsourced company, Coru, which is the company doing the profiles, that they already have in their database. So they see massive benefits through hiring a more diversified pool, because so you end up with people who have similar behavioral tendencies but they have different disciplines. So you could see a similar behavioral makeup for someone who had done IT, someone who had done English Lit, and someone who had done maths. So you end up with a far bigger variety of background from a socioeconomic perspective than you do from the existing model, because you will, if you go outside of the Ivy League schools, you'll have people coming from a different mindset. So you'll get diversity in that sense. It's obviously totally blind on things like race, ethnicity, sexual orientation, all that. It's obviously totally blind on. So you'll get some kinds of diversification, but that is one of what I think the idea of having people who think too similarly is certainly a danger that the bank and the other employers who do use this technology will be mindful of.
Will it catch on?
It's already catching on, actually. So I've had questions from various other bankers within other banks asking me for information about this and how Deutsche do this. And I've also been reached out to by several other companies who are offering various analytical tools that they say can also help you tap into a broader range of talent. So yes, there are two different trends here. One is the idea of behavioral profiling, and the other is the idea of really harnessing technology to tap into a broader talent pool. I think certainly harnessing technology for a broader talent pool, that is something which is going to become in the mainstream for not just banking, but for every industry. In terms of the behavioral piece, people go about it differently. So there are people concerned about hiring too many people of the same type. There's also the evidence-based. So Deutsche's whole concept and the whole concept of how the core profiling works is that the people who did well here in the last decade will have the same behavior makeup as the people who do well here in the next decade. That may not be true. The characteristics which would have made you a good performer in the last 5 years may not endure. I think that's the part that hasn't been tested.
And that would be even more true of those who were there before 2007, I suspect. But we'll...
the world does change.
Indeed. Thank you very much for that, Laura. That's it for this week. All that's left for me to do is to thank Laura, Martin and Caroline here in the studio, Ben and Alistair in New York, and also our guest from the IMD Business School, Professor Jennifer Jordan. Thank you also for listening. Remember, you can keep up to date with all of the latest banking stories at ft.com/banking. Banking Weekly was produced by Alex Wisniewska and Amy Keane. Until next week, goodbye.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of The Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is all about health prevention and vaccines. I speak to Kate Hashey at GSK.
For every dollar invested in improving health, there's an economic return of $2 to $4.
Murray Aitken at IQVIA Institute for Human Data Science.
The benefits of adult vaccination are compelling.
And David Sinclair at the International Longevity Centre.
Preventable conditions amongst those aged 50 to 64 in the UK cost $27 billion a year.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts.